Lloyd Moss has been a familiar part of WQXR since 1955. It's certainly one of the longest-running associations between a station and a personality in contemporary New York City radio history. Lloyd's one of the nation's best-known and most well-regarded announcers in classical radio. He's interviewed many of music's finest through the years and has been putting great performances in the spotlight for decades. But rarely has that light been focused on Lloyd, so on the occasion of his retirement from regular staff duties at WQXR, we thought it was high time indeed to talk with Lloyd about Lloyd. This is a great pleasure for me, I have to tell
my
you.
My favorite subject.
When did you first begin to work in radio?
1945.
You were just a boy, a mere boy.
I was just a mere tad.
Where did you start?
In Seoul, Korea. Armed Forces Radio Service. I had played trombone while being trained to invade Japan, an invasion that never took place. Mm-hmm. Second World War is what we're discussing. Somebody discovered in making assignments that I had indeed been a musician, and I was assigned to a show group, 27th Special Service in Seoul, Korea.
You did entertainment for the other
soldiers? We did
soldiers.
Entertainment. We wrote some skits, and we traveled from encampment to encampment, entertaining our fellow soldiers. And at some point, the older gents were sent back to the States, and we younger ones were called upon to entertain, to perform. And so I wrote the aforementioned skits with a friend of mine, a corporal. And as I say, we went to all these encampments and performed. And at one of the performances, I, just kidding around, grabbed a hold of a microphone and called to my confrere, Chuck Smith, report to the stage, using my deepest voice.
Uh-huh.
And Matt O'Donnell came racing in, shouting, "Who was that? What was that voice? Oh, my God, who is it?" It was only me. But Matt had been doing some volunteer work on the Armed Forces radio station, WVTP, Seoul, Korea. And on Sundays, he appeared in a program called The Week in Review, a news program. And he got me onto that program, and I was fulfilling my regular roles. But on Sunday, I would show up at the radio station in the middle of Seoul, Korea, and participate in that show, doing a lot of voices, a lot of imitations. When the announcer would say, "Only last week, John Forsythe said," and then I would be the voice of John Forsythe, and that, whoever that is. That was the beginning of the career. Eventually, I transferred from the special service unit to the radio station, and I knew that I was the right peg in the right hole. Mm. From the very beginning, it was and remains a love affair between me and the microphone.
Right. So you came back to the States and began to pursue civilian radio work at that time?
Yes. You want to hear the tracking?
Yes, please.
All right. Following WVTP in Seoul, Korea, there I am back in the States, and it's WLBR Lebanon, Pennsylvania, WEST Easton, Pennsylvania, WHOL Allentown, Pennsylvania, WAVZ New Haven, Connecticut, WHLI Hempstead, Long Island, WNYC, sorry, and the Voice of America, and finally WQXR as a relief man in the beginning.
Did you work at Voice of America? You were full-time there for a while here in New York?
Yes, and I was not announcing. It's the one break in that trajectory. I was producing for the Japanese desk of the Voice of America.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a lot of fun, but it was not what I really wanted to do. I loved radio. I had now spent a few years doing it, and I wanted back, and there came an opening at WQXR. The rest, as they say, is finish the sentence.
And indeed, but we aren't. We have more history to tell before we can finish it. Because when did you first learn about WQXR just as a radio station?
My father had a beauty shop in Brooklyn on Kingston Avenue. And he had a little Bakelite radio. I think that's the only kind of plastic that existed back then. And he had WQXR on all the time. And every once in a while, a customer would come in and say, "Oh, turn that off. I can't stand that kind of music." And he'd say, "Leave."
Really?
He was loyal to the station back then. So I had that lovely picture of the radio station, if you can have pictures at a radio station.
You certainly can.
Throughout. And when I landed on QXR, no one was prouder than my daddy.
Yeah, I bet. Was your father always a fan of what was called in those days good music?
Yes, but he also loved novelty stuff. Come a rainstorm, put your rubbers on your feet, that kind of thing, to the tune of a pounded-out piano. So he was really all around as far as his musical tastes were concerned, and I like to think that in some ways I emulate that.
Well, that sounds exactly like you, as I know you off microphone, appreciating jazz and great, wonderful music of that sort. What about your own affair or your own relationship with classical music? You had the great privilege of growing up in a time when classical music was taught in public schools, although you learned songs to famous melodies in the classical canon. Were lyrics.
Well, in the very beginning, this is the symphony that Schubert wrote but never finished.
There are dozens of those.
Yes, there are. There are. I can't think of any offhand, but...
it's worth pursuing on another occasion. What about your own musical training? You were a trombonist. When did you begin to play?
It was dance band stuff and swing. I had a friend living in the same apartment building with me on Schenectady Avenue in Brooklyn. And he had a brother, and the brother played tenor saxophone with the brand new Harry James Orchestra that was racking up all kinds of, no pun intended, records.
Indeed.
And Sammy invited us backstage where we saw the actual musicians who had appeared on our 78s, and I was smitten. Richie decided that he was going to play trumpet, a la Harry James. Therefore, there was little left for me but to turn to the trombone, which was a larger instrument, and I could outclass him in that way. And we formed a band, and we got the arrangements, the stuff that Benny Goodman was playing and Artie Shaw was playing
you
and
could
Tommy
buy,
Dorsey was
you
playing.
You could buy those charts?
Yeah.
Oh, interesting.
Not the charts as such. I mean, not with the individual parts, but the charts, yeah.
The tunes you could get. The sheet music. Yeah. And then you made your own arrangements.
Exactly.
Well, so you had musical training then from an early
throughout
age.
My high school, I was eventually became the High School of Performing Arts. It was Metropolitan Vocational High, and they taught all kinds of wonderful things, including music and art. I went there for the art, because that was going to be my profession initially. Then switched to music, and along came, what did I just say the name of the school was?
Metropolitan.
And then came Metropolitan Vocational High School, which then separated its music department and started, come on, help me.
The High School of Performing Arts
Then started the High School of Performing Arts, which eventually ended up being a part of LaGuardia High School in Lincoln Center here in Manhattan.
Right. So you had that training. You were playing the trombone.
Playing the trombone, I learned arranging and orchestrating, and the trombone playing was not only devoted to swing music, but we learned classical music, too. We were able to play classical music.
And this was all high school?
All high school. It's a wonderful school with wonderful teachers.
Stunning. Stunning that you had all that training so early on. Well, all right, so...
Which didn't show up until there I am a couple of years later in Seoul, Korea, and somebody discovering that I'd had that background. So, boy, did it pay off in a practical way.
Yeah, indeed, indeed. Well, when you came to WQXR, how did the audition... You had to do an audition, I'm sure.
Yeah, the Voice of America, where I was employed, moved down to Washington, and I did not go with it. And so I was looking around for work, and I sent a postcard to various radio stations, one of which was WQXR, and was notified that they were holding auditions on a specific date. When I showed up, the studio was crammed with people who wanted that job. And I auditioned, and the result was a sharing of first place with another announcer who had been working on WOR, and they would call me one day to fill in, and then they would call him the next day. Sorry, I don't remember his name, but he disappeared rather quickly, so there was no point in remembering his name.
Right.
Because I then had it exclusively to myself.
Yeah.
And that's how I worked at QXR for a year, filling in for others, and finally an opening came, and it was perfectly natural for me to
slip into it.
Slide in.
Yeah. Do you remember your audition? What was the process of your audition? Do you remember?
Oh, that's a tough one, and it would be interesting to have that. It was a sham typed-out introduction to a hypothetical musical program, and the names in that script were exceedingly challenging and covered three or four of our basic languages, what we used today on WQXR. I mean, we really have to be facile in our pronunciation of Italian and French and German and, I guess, a couple of others, Spanish.
Yeah.
So that tested one to the ultimate, to the max, as they say now.
Well, now that brings another question. Where did your language facility come from? Was that something you discovered early on?
When I got to Korea, we had removed the Japanese who had held sway there, had occupied the country for such a long, long while. And everyone in the spillover was speaking Japanese, not Korean. All the Koreans had been forbidden to use their own language in school and in business. So I started picking up some Korean. There had been a program presented, this still is during the Second World War, that would allow young men to continue a form of their education while getting into the uniform of the United States Army. And one could choose one of three divisions. It would be English, engineering, no, it would be science, engineering, or English, or Japanese, because, again, we were planning to stage that invasion that never happened. But when I arrived at NYU Uptown, no longer in existence, it was discovered that I did not get placed in that subdivision. The subdivision itself then became passé. They would fix all that and get me into, I was allowed the choice of English, engineering, or Japanese. They assured me, the non-commissioned officers did, that eventually that would all be put to rights and that I would get that training in Japanese once the papers went through. The papers never went through, but while I was waiting for what never happened, I got a hold of a book in Japanese so that I would not be caught wanting.
Completely unawares. Yeah.
When the program was put into place. And so I had a few phrases in Japanese. When we arrived in Korea, all I heard around me was Japanese. And I used a phrase like konnichiwa, good day, good afternoon. And immediately some of the younger Koreans would race over to me and complain about the way they were being treated or what their view was on our occupation or anything of that sort. Now, I didn't know what they were talking about, of course, but as they nodded vehemently, I would nod in echo to their gestures and eventually started picking up phrases that became more and more familiar to me. And soon I was speaking some Japanese, and I had my little book with me, and I proceeded to extend my knowledge, and that's how that first language came to pass. My facility, if you want to call it that, I'm not facile at all, but I can handle the basics of Japanese.
Sure. So where did you learn the Italian and the French and the German and the Spanish that we use every day on WQXR?
Well, I never learned the German. And I don't speak very much German, but I know some Yiddish, and they're similar, the two languages.
Right.
So I can hold my own with that. And then the way you do, Jeffrey, you listen and adopt what you think is going to be utilitarian.
And then get corrections along the way.
Yes,
yeah,
sure.
Absolutely.
Spanish, I've been studying Spanish. Italian, I studied Italian in preparation for a trip to Italy with my son. And we've visited France more than once and started studying French here in New York City on a regular basis, Anne joining me.
Right.
And it's loads of fun. It's like cracking a code.
Well, it is.
While providing insights into the way people think, because when you're wedded to a different language, you have a different set of thought processes. It's a fascinating concept.
And true, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah.
And even when you begin to study for a little while, you'll feel that switch coming on, that you're moving into that other world. It really, as you say,
and you're also able to show off, you know, especially if there are people around you who don't speak the language. And the big thing for us in radio is to concentrate on pronunciation,
right?
Which is pretty elusive, actually. There are some subtleties in pronunciation that are hard to come by.
Well, and some sounds that we don't make in English that are made in other languages.
Exactly.
And
pack up your umlauts and get out.
That's it. That's exactly right. Well, I want to talk more about your work at WQXR, but you did other kinds of radio. You've referred more than once when we played the Donna Diana overture of von Reznicek, that was the theme of Sergeant Preston of the Yukon. So you did some other kinds of radio work as well, besides sort of basic station announcing, because that was not quite the end, but close to the end of the glory years of radio when television was coming on the scene. But you enjoyed some of that.
Well, I signed on WQXR, as I said, in 1955, and I stayed here till 1971. And the reason that I left in 1971 was that I had an enormous number of assignments outside the station on a freelance basis. And I eventually was so busy with the outside work that I couldn't juggle both. And for practical matters, I left WQXR knowing that I would still be connected with it because I was doing First Hearing and This Is My Music.
Yeah, two long-running programs on the station at that time.
First Hearing, 26 years or so, and This Is My Music, something like 8 years. So I have really, and then I came back because it soured. You
know? and we needed you.
And they wanted me, and I was delighted to come back in 1989, and I've been here ever since.
Right. Well, your colleagues at WQXR are, again, like you, some of the most esteemed people in this business. But two of the long-running programs you had, I wanted to talk to you about. So tell me about how This Is My Music came about and how you arranged those interviews. You spoke to so many prestigious people.
I had left the station, as I say, in 1971. But Walter Nyman, who was then in charge of the station,
General manager,
was feeding me things. I mean, if something came up where he thought I might be able to handle the job, he would contact me, which was so kind and so selfless. They had an idea for First Hearing. Jacques Frey was a big star on WQXR, a Frenchman with a romantic voice that women fell in love with, people fell in love with.
Mm-hmm.
And when Jacques died, there was a big hole in the operation. Several people applied for the position. Frey came to this country as part of a duo piano team, Frey and Bragiotti. They had appeared on the London stage playing the music of George Gershwin. They were big stuff when they got here in New York, and when Jacques died, as I say, there was a void. Bragiotti, his erstwhile partner, tried out for the job, and they let him have the 3 to 5, was the stint at that time. They had him try out for a couple of weeks, and it didn't work. And after a few more attempts with others, they got a hold of Robert Lawrence, who was a music critic of that time. And Robert Lawrence had an idea that he put into play, a program called First Hearing, where you picked up the LP. You'll have to explain to our listeners what an LP is. I hardly remember what it stands for. Truth and Justice, I believe. Yeah. which came sheathed in cellophane. And he, on the air, with a great deal of fanfare as he cut through the cellophane and let it rustle in front of the microphone.
Is that right?
For the very first time, ladies and gentlemen, here comes this LP, and I'm going to play cut 2.
And he'd drop the needle on it.
And he'd drop the needle on it, and then he'd lift up the needle and say, well, I think that was terrible. You know, he was rather a rambunctious critic, but he also was less than effectual.
Hmm.
And I overheard the powers that be talking at some point. I was a regular staff announcer, and staff announcers back then did nothing but station breaks and newscasts and the errant commercial or two. We were not booked the way we are these days, not as busy as we were. At any rate, I heard them saying that they were going to drop Robert Lawrence, and I went to, I think it was Elliot Sanger, and said, I'd like to try, because no one had tried from the announcing staff.
Mr. Sanger, the co-founder of the radio station.
Yes,
by the way,
and the uncle of David E. Sanger.
Who's the White House correspondent
exactly,
for the Times these days.
Oh, and I have to tell you more about I don't know if this is the appropriate time, but tell you more about Elliot Sanger. He only had one thing, one order that he issued to the troops, as it were, and that was never say coming up. It sounds like someone vomiting. Do not say coming up. It's reverse peristalsis. That's what comes basically to mind. I want you to know, Jeffrey, that in all these years, I have never issued that phrase from my lips.
Is that right?
I have never said coming up. Now, whoever this interview gets exposed to will no doubt find it very difficult to say coming up this piece of music.
I have a feeling in tribute to Mr. Sanger, I may adopt the same policy, but it could be a challenge. I may have trouble with that. We'll have to see.
Yeah.
So first
anyway,
hearing.
So that's when I embarked on first hearing.
You said I have another idea for the program, or let's extend it to a few people.
No, I didn't have an idea for the program. I still don't have an idea for the program. Other than it was an enlargement of the concept that Robert Lawrence had brought to the station. Instead of one record being listened to and one person issuing a verdict, it would be a panel of music critics issuing their verdicts individually.
And you became the host of that show.
Yeah. I became the host of that show because Walter Nyman, again, asked that I do it. Pulled me in from outside.
In the right place at the right time.
Exactly.
Not a small part of any career. And George Jelinek and Bob Sherman programmed that program for the duration of its
time. Yes, it was mostly George Jelinek. He took over early in the game, and it ran with him for a long, long time.
Tell me about This Is My Music.
Well, This Is My Music had a singular concept. You would contact someone who was well-known in the arts, but not as a musician. In other words, the guest who was being interviewed was not a musician.
Was not in the musical field, yeah.
But had strong likes and sometimes dislikes of music on a private basis. I mean, I remember Tony Randall saying his wife, Florence, was going to get rid of him because the attic floor was sagging because of his many 78s. And, many other people who were just entranced by music, but did not pursue it professionally.
Those were people that you had it must have been a thrill to meet those people, because they were from the top of the worlds of art and journalism, literature, all over the place.
Do you have a list?
I have only a short one, so we'll look at
my
it.
My memory is so
that's quite all right.
But yes, thrilling. A lot of actors.
Now, let me ask you in that regard, during the time of your association with WQXR, when you were host of First Hearing and This Is My Music, you weren't a regular staff announcer for a period of years.
Right.
You did lots of commercial voiceovers, and you did, I'm to understand, though you've told me very little about this ever, you pursued some theatrical work, some film work. You did some other things here and there. Is that correct?
Yeah, nothing that was extraordinary, but I was on a soap opera for 3 or 4 sessions, As the World Turns. I played Arnold Bennett, who was a publisher and was being asked by a young woman if he, sub rosa, on the quiet, would publish her boyfriend's book without letting her boyfriend know that she had paid for it. Well, I had to wrestle with my conscience on that one. Then there was a movie called The Soldier, and I had a couple of scenes, all of which were cut but one, where I played an Israeli diplomat on camera. Off camera, I was a voice bringing Paul Newman and Tom Cruise to Atlantic City to gamble. What's the name of the movie?
The Hustler 2?
Color of Money. The Color of Money. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Tell me that again. You were an off-camera voice. Just tell me. Give me that.
Oh, yeah, for a brief period. That was The Color of Money. I got a phone call. I had narrated a film on how to gamble that was used by one of the big hotels in Atlantic City. And when someone checked into his room, he was advised via a little poster to push a button and the television set would come on and the film would be played. Gamble with your head and not with your heart, something of that sort. And it was a 30-minute narration. One day, long after I had done it, I got a phone call at home saying, "This is Walt Disney Studios. We would like permission to use a portion of your narration in a film we're making about gambling in Atlantic City. What would you want for permission to use that film slug?" And I said, $50,000 and the leading role in your next production. And she said, "We'll give you $350." And I said, I'll take it. Then, like 3 weeks later, 4 weeks later, I'd almost forgotten about it. Phone rings again and says, "Martin Scorsese said that we can't use that piece of film. There's some distortion in it. Would you mind going into the studio and doing it again?" I said, "Okay, but this time I want my
$50,000 in lead role."
And she said, "Well, you know, we could get anyone to do it because it's fresh. It doesn't have to be your voice, anyone." So I said, "I'll take the..." She said, I tell you what, I'll give you $500 and, what do you call a listing?
A credit.
And a screen credit.
Oh.
I said, "Okay, done." So my name is on it, and that movie plays over and over and over again.
Sure.
Speaking of over and over and over, you're wondering where this is going to lead.
I am indeed.
The finest voiceover I ever did went, "Listerine twice a day." It ran for something like 3 years. They kept changing the body of the commercial.
It was a TV spot.
They kept changing it, and every time they changed it, I'd get another fee.
Yeah.
And you also got fees for the amount of time it was running.
Sure.
I mean, for the
frequency. Yeah.
So that was my apogee.
Listerine twice a day.
Yeah. Listerine twice a day.
That's just grand.
And the other one, I'm not through. This was for radio program called Monitor, and it was the whole weekend was considered a program, so you'd get a talent fee for whatever you did that was repeated throughout the weekend.
Oh, my
and
goodness.
What I my line was Gruen, the latest look in time. Every hour on the hour, a check was cut.
Oh, that's just amazing. Yeah, that was such a huge program, NBC's Monitor.
Really, you remember
important
it?
Radio
yeah.
program. The truth yeah. is, I've never
Leonard
heard
Bernstein,
it.
Yeah.
No, the truth is, I've never heard it. Oh. It was not, in my town where I grew up, we didn't have an NBC station.
It's a wonderful concept.
Yeah. Just great. Let's see. Art. Visual art. The radio cannot help us there. But we have a website now, and at WQXR.com, we're going to show a little bit of your art. So I wanted you to talk about the people in these caricatures.
Is that my art?
Yes, it is. We have,
holding up
we
for
have
me?
Your art. Now, one of these pictures is of Jacques Frey.
Yes.
And this is a caricature. You drew it entirely.
Yes.
And what? This he apparently had, was this a cheese that was wrapped? He had a longtime sponsor?
No. This gesture was just a Gallic, my attempt at a Gallic
the gesture. Caption. The caption.
Yes, there was a cheese. I don't know whether it was actually a product or whether I was just mimicking the sort of thing that he was required to do.
Right.
That he would deign to do. I mean, he was really too classy to be touched by any kind of commercialism.
There are two other drawings
making
here.
Making love to the microphone, yeah.
There are two other drawings here of people who I presume worked at WQXR off mic, because I don't know their names, nor have
Excuse
I heard
me.
Them.
Excuse me. I think you might be confusing people, because we didn't go into the
Oh.
What led to this.
Yeah.
The caption that I provided was, "And with merely a zip of the tab, there is your cheese."
Yes, it adds a special note to have the accent on it. Here's a drawing of a fellow named Lou Klein Klaus.
Yeah, he was chief engineer,
or
whatever the title was back then. He was in charge of all the engineers.
Well, then that explains the caption, which reads...
And it was Christmas 53, I gather. Yes, it shows an electric switch, on at the top, off at the bottom. Lou Klein Klaus saying, "Say, Cobaugh," who was one of our engineers who was not quite with it.
Uh-huh.
"How do you turn this thing on?"
It looked
like Klein Klaus. It was a good sketch, if I may say so myself.
Just genius. Here's the third one. It's a fellow named Norman McGee, who had to have been an account executive. He has some money in his...
Yeah, he was the head of sales. Yeah. And he's lighting a cigar with a dollar bill. Probably be a $10 bill today. Norman McGee. You've got room. Just give them shorter selections.
He's talking about putting more commercials on the hour.
Exactly.
On the hour of the program.
A practice unfamiliar to you and me.
Absolutely. It's never occurred in my time.
No.
Tell me about your drawing career. When did you this was your first love and your ostensible career, your planned career.
Never happened. I started drawing, I think, from the time I held a pencil. I remember we had to draw in kindergarten. We had to draw a Christmas tree and draw all the things that we would want under the Christmas tree. Well, none of us could draw. I mean, you know, we were, 5 years old, I guess, 4 years old? I drew a typewriter. Now, some of your younger audience won't know what that is.
What that is either. Yeah. We'll put them next to the LPs.
A cozy spot. And we turned in these drawings. And I drew a picture of a typewriter. And the teacher went around the room looking at all these various things, and she got to my table and she said, "Such a damning sentence. Lloyd, what is that?" Can you imagine being asked, "Lloyd, what is that?" Yeah. "It's a typewriter."
Can't you tell? Anybody would know.
I was hurt, but I considered myself an artist even then. I mean, I took that very seriously. And then throughout grade school, I was always the artist in the class. I was always the tallest. And I was always the artist. And those were two things, when they got challenged later on, I found devastating. Because those both had taken place over such a long period.
Sure.
But I drew and I drew and I drew. My father was very good at sketching, and my grandfather, as a matter of fact, had sketched. Never occurred to me that I would do anything else. And I arrived at the School of Industrial Art here in Manhattan High School, had to take a test to be accepted at the school, and I passed the test, which was difficult. It was a high honor to have succeeded in that regard. When I reported for my first day, everyone around me was a better artist. You know, it's amazing. No shortage of talent.
Yeah.
Certainly in New York, no shortage. And I could have sat it out and tried harder and let it fester and maybe flower, but I chose not to, and I went back to Metropolitan Vocational High School for their music program, because at the same time that I was doing all this drawing, I was by now playing trombone as well. And so it turned into a musical career.
So the art became merely
the art
an avocation.
Became secondary.
Yeah.
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 But a very strong secondary. And as a matter of fact, about, it must be 7 or 8 years ago, for a few years, I was the editorial cartoonist of the Croton Courtland News, and I won the second prize for domestic cartoon. Domestic is the wrong word. Whatever isn't professional.
Not amateur, but...
No,
but
it wouldn't be amateur.
Avocational and not... Yeah,
I can't think. But two years in a row won a New York State award. In cartooning.
Wow.
So right up until that point, and when I decided to freelance, when I left QXR that first time, I'd have to backtrack once again. We had a brass band in Croton-on-Hudson, and I dusted off my trombone for that, got it out of its case.
Wonderful.
And went back to it again because I had stopped playing when I went after I got out of the Army. Sure. Gave up the trombone and really slowed down on the drawing and painting as well. But I fully intend to get back to all of that.
I was going to say, you may have occasion to do just a little bit more work. I have two more photographs that we'll just piece these together later on. This seems to have been perhaps a short-lived career, but a very distinguished one as a model. This is the cover of a book, and if I'm not mistaken, that's Mrs. Moss next to you.
Yeah, Anne was a professional high fashion model. She was one of the first Does She or Doesn't She girls. I think she was the first, as a matter of fact. They flew her down to Florida. I immediately caught cold and flew down, left QXR on sick leave so I could lie down and be with her and watch the shoot.
Wow, so and, she and her hairdresser and you knew for sure, I presume.
Yes, her head rumpler. The title of the book was Wake Up in Bed Together by a couple of doctors, the Noltes. And they asked us if we would pose.
And so you did.
And so we did. to the chagrin of our children, I think.
Well, I'm happy to report that you're still doing just exactly that. So at least the book worked for you. Here's a photograph of a very young Lloyd Moss, and there is a radio sign in front of this. It's clearly an orchestra on stage, but I don't know if you're on the radio then or not.
Yes.
This is 1948.
Yeah. For the past several years, I had been attending every Wednesday night, as you no doubt know, the Cajun Restaurant in Chelsea here in Manhattan.
Which has a wonderful place for jazz.
For jazz.
Players, yeah.
And on Wednesday nights, Eddie Davis and a group of extremely talented musicians performed. As a matter of fact, you accompanied me one of those Wednesday
been on
nights.
Been there on a number of occasions.
Uh-huh.
Yeah,
uh-huh.
Wonderful.
Yeah. We always sat close to the stage, and Eddie Davis, the leader, banjo player, and I would trade reminiscences and observations about the history of the kind of music that we were listening to or playing. And at some point, I said, well, did you ever hear of the Corn Cobblers? And Eddie said, the Corn Cobblers? You knew the Corn Cobblers? And he went on at great length about the Corn Cobblers. They played corny music and did it with style and with a great sense of humor. And that flag that you see attached to the microphone in front of me says NBC. It looks like West, but it's W-E-S-T.
Hmm, I see. I thought it was maybe a network division.
The call letters of the radio station.
Oh, very good.
And, yeah, well, a division of NBC, right.
Right.
Which is also on the flag.
And so where was this?
Easton, Pennsylvania, the aforementioned Easton, Pennsylvania. And it was a one-shot broadcast, I think. And I was asked to be the announcer. Handsome devil, huh?
Indeed.
Oh,
it's a
boy.
Shame you weren't on
Where
television.
Where has it
all
gone?
Yeah. Oh, no. You still have almost all of it, absolutely.
I led you into that.
I think I hit it fairly well.
Yeah, but I do bridle at the word almost.
I'll
try to hold back. Yeah.
It's understandable. Thank you. Okay. Well, now, one of your, it seems to me, longest-lasting legacies in the world, besides all the wonderful broadcasts you've done, the trouble with radio, of course, is that it's ethereal. It goes out and then it disappears. But you've written wonderful books.
Thank you.
The word is ephemeral, but we'll take care of that. You've written wonderful books for children based on, again, another of your amazing skills, which is your ability at wordplay. Tell me about your writing of children's books and how these came to be.
Well, as I had told you earlier, throughout my childhood, I drew and I drew and I drew. I also wrote. I didn't mention that. I loved, and still do, to rhyme and to meet the challenges of rhyming and of meter. And when I became a father, four children, I read to them all the time, in addition to which I fashioned, call them greeting cards, if you will, for any and all occasions in their lives, prominently birthdays, but other events as well, bringing home a good paper from school and that kind of thing. Always in rhyme and always illustrated by yours truly. And they saved the examples of the drawings. Mm. No, none of them ever got thrown away, I learned later. Years later, Ann Mao, who was my son Bryce's girlfriend, now his wife and the mother of his children, was working for Simon & Schuster. She phoned me one day and said, Bryce was showing me the poems that you have written throughout the years for your children. I have been given an assignment to ferret out new works, and you're the first person I'm calling. You should write a children's book.
How about that?
Write a children's book. Nah, impossible. Doc Seuss has done it. There's no point in my even trying. My usual, as Anne would point out, negative self. Always the negative response first. Later I could be turned around somewhat.
Uh-huh.
And that's what happened here. I remember it was a Saturday and I was lying on the bed with a big pad balanced on my knees, doing a silly drawing of an elephant with a pair of glasses on and crumpling it up in embarrassment, even though there was no one else to witness it, and tossing that crumpled chunk on the floor and trying something else and tearing out that page. And at some point, Anne walked into the room, and I said, don't talk to me. I think I've got something here. And the something that I had was an array of instruments in order, not necessarily of importance, but in order of my preference, and drawing on my experience with them. Well, it was going to be a counting book as well, because I had been told that counting books did very well by my same now daughter-in-law.
Mm-hmm.
The trombone plays all alone, and the O-N-E in trombone is one, so it had to be the first instrument.
Sure.
Second one, it's perfectly logical. There's the brass section. I have just started. I'm in brass. I will stay there for a moment or two, and there comes the trumpet and the French horn. That takes care of them, and now I will move on to strings. Zin, 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 the sound of the violin. I tried throughout the book to enlist sounds that would somehow emulate the sound of the instrument. Impossible to do fully, but I think zin, 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 the bow coursing over the strings, approximates that sound pretty much, and it worked its way throughout the entire book. When I was finished, I sent it to Simon and Schuster, to my now daughter-in-law, and she said, well, they're interested, and they like it very much, but you'll have to shorten da-da-da-da, whatever. And I said, what? Me? What's the word I want now?
Not revise, not edit.
Well, let's drop that.
Okay.
What? Me tamper with this masterpiece? I cried. Dern tootin'. So I got back to it. And each of the verses was too long, but that allowed me to shorten them and use the best of each couplet, as it were. Sent it back, and she said, we want it. And I thought, that's the way business is done. Ho-hum. I'm very pleased. When I saw the first sketches by Marjorie Priceman, I was blown away. As you know, you've seen the book.
Sure.
She is absolutely wonderful, and her wondrous talent led to the Caldecott Award, one of, I think, four books to get the Caldecott honor that year, out of the thousands of children's books that come out.
It's a huge industry, yes.
It's extraordinary.
So to be singled out.
Zin has done. Yeah. Zin is now in its fourth printing.
And it's been translated into a number of other languages.
Yes, into Japanese, Chinese, and Korean, and now French for the Canadian market, where it's going to go into 100,000 boxes of Cheerios, which is repeating an event that took place a year and a half ago, almost 2 years ago now, where in certain boxes of Cheerios there appeared, and in 1.6 million boxes of Cheerios, there appeared the book, wow. Zin, 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 a Violin. So think of how many breakfast tables that they rest on.
Well, and what a good ambassador you've been for classical music, besides being on the radio.
And your use of the word ephemeral, yeah, I think the phrase on the air really covers it. It's, you're on the air. You make an utterance. It wafts away on some breeze or other. You can be pleased with it. And you can even tell your friends, God, I was funny today. But, that's blowing your own horn, if I may use a musical term.
Indeed. Well, now, that's not the only book. Zin is not the only book.
No.
There are two others.
After that came Our Marching Band and Music Is, both of them published by G.P. Putnam Sons, both of which got published because G.P. Putnam Sons and Penguin Putnam advertise on WQXR, and our sales manager, Penny Gaffney, said, let me see if I can submit some of these things to some of the powers that be.
And you have others in the can, as they say, I imagine, or do you have plans to work on some more?
I've got a couple in the can, as they say, but at the moment nobody wants them.
Yeah.
You really have to stay with it if you're going to be another Harry Potter.
All in time.
Creator.
All in time,
yeah.
No doubt.
Yeah.
Do you have some other WQXR stories that you'd like to tell? Because I don't know exactly what you'd like to focus on or who you'd like to mention, and you needn't. I'm just wondering. Have we missed anything on your notes?
No, other than it was truly a great privilege to serve on First Hearing and This Is My Music. This Is My Music allowed me to meet a lot of people outside the music industry. But First Hearing gave me access to and friendship with some of the really wonderful musicians. When we started out, our panel consisted of the wonderful Edward Downes and Martin Bookspan and Irving Culloden. George Jelinek was our producer. I got to know those people, and I got to know their associates as well. And we forged some long-ranging friendships as a result. We've lost a few people. Richard Capp just died a few days ago. I was at his service day before yesterday.
Yeah, terrific, terrific musician.
Wonderful musician, but there were just so many.
Tell me about your association with Thomas Schippers. He was a wonderful, very charismatic conductor whose career, he just died young, and so it was cut short. But I didn't know that you had an association with him.
Well, he's no longer with us, and so I don't want to attack him, but he did me dirt.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. He was to appear with the New York Philharmonic out of Brooklyn High School in their auditorium, visit the school's goodwill for WQXR and for the cause of music in general. It was a live show, and it was to begin at 2 o'clock, and I had about a one-minute introduction that I read. But as we got to airtime, toward airtime, there was no Thomas Schippers.
Oh, my goodness.
The orchestra had assembled, but there was no Thomas Schippers. I read my one-minute or maybe one-and-a-half-minute introduction, and there was no Thomas Schippers. And then I started ad-libbing about the cause of music today and how wonderful music is where children are concerned and what this can lead to. And they will be finer persons as a result of the music that they are exposed to, and WQXR is happy to be able to be a part of that exposure, and blah, blah, blah. Where's Thomas Schippers? Where's Thomas Schippers? And some guy who was working backstage appeared in his undershirt, and while I'm doing all this fervid ad-libbing, he says to me, he talks to me, "Hey, Schippers isn't here yet, huh?" And I'm listening to him, and suddenly I lose my balance. Where was I? What was it? This persiflage that I was handing out. And so I said, "But I believe I see Thomas Schippers in the wings right now." I didn't, and I was really taking a terrible chance. I do believe that Thomas Schippers is standing in the wings right now, and he's about to make, yes, I do think that is Thomas Schippers. Back and forth with his stretching as much as I can, suddenly he appeared. I hear the audience applaud. Thomas Schippers appears. He takes over. My mic is cut off. And I go, phew. And I head backstage and out the door to go into the yard, the schoolyard, and have, pardon me, friends and neighbors, a smoke, because that's what we were doing back then.
Yes.
And no sooner did I step out the door than it closed with a resounding thwunk and click. And I was stuck on this Saturday afternoon in the wilds of Brooklyn with a mile-high set of barbed wire fencing between me and the sidewalk. And I laughed the way you're laughing. I mean, it was a...
What could you do?
Cataclysmic. Well, the first thing I did was I sat down on the step outside this aforementioned door, lit my pipe, and puffed. And then I decided I had to get back into the building, but I tried the other two doors as well. No, they were locked tight. Some kid went walking by this empty schoolyard, and I called out to him, thinking I could get him to walk in, and he thought I was crazy, I guess, because he kept walking. And eventually, I climbed that fence, got to the other side, as one does, and walked in the front door and sat down.
Oh, my goodness.
That's my story concerning Thomas Schippers, who was late and didn't bring a note.
and locked you out of the building without your cell phone, too,
yes.
Which there were none in those days.
Exactly.
Well, Lloyd, you had an extraordinary career, and I want to speak just for a moment as we close this about your personal life, because you've had a long marriage and your children. So can we just do the numbers and the names?
Yeah, okay. I was married in 1958. What is that? 48 years.
Congratulations.
Right? Thank you. And we have four children. Very neat. Two boys, two girls. The boys at the top, Bradley, Bryce, Liana, and Nanette, who calls herself West for business purposes.
And you have a grandchild or two?
We have two grandchildren now, one of whom is named Odysseus, and he's 6 years old, and a little girl we adopted from Korea, as a matter of fact, and she's 2 years old, and her name is Aubrey. And that pretty much, oh, and of course our cat, Rosie.
We must not overlook
Rosie. No, don't overlook the cat.
Not fair at all. Well, it's an extraordinary career, and You're an extraordinary person, multi-talented in ways that the radio audience has had little chance to see, but which I'm glad we've had a moment to speak about today.
Thank you for your kind words. Oh,
it's lovely of you. It's an enormous privilege to have listened to you on the radio, admired you from afar, become associated with you, and have become a colleague as well. And on behalf of all of the listeners who will enjoy the stories that you've told, I thank you so much, and we will enjoy you on WQXR in other forms for years to come, I know.
Well, thank you. That's so good of you, and it's been a pleasure doing this with you, delving into my past with you, Jeff. You're an adroit interviewer and a credit to the station and to my memory of greatness at WQXR.
Thank you, Lloyd.